From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope, senior lecturer at the Graduate School of Education, and Dan Schwartz, the dean of the Graduate School of Education. However, Denise is on assignment, so we're very lucky to have a guest co-host, Dr. Marilia Pezzo, who has taught, who does research on helping people get healthy behaviors, and who is a little bit of a ham. So it turns out she was like the star of her high school play. And so we thought she would be a natural on the radio. So welcome, Marilee.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Dan.
So does it feel like you're a substitute teacher?
It does. But, you know, luckily, since we're on radio, no one can throw spitballs at me.
Okay. Okay. I'll do my best to resist. So so you taught students like summer school health. Did you ever get to see what became of them?
No, I'm bummed. I didn't. But, you know, my dad was like a legendary health teacher, and he got to teach for a really long time, and he ended up teaching so long that some students ended up one time he got pulled over for speeding, and it ended up being one of his ex-students, so he got out of the ticket.
He
so,
did. It yeah. wasn't it wasn't a chance for revenge.
No. Luckily, they all loved him.
I hated you. You're getting a double speeding ticket.
Right.
So in Alaska, I had a very interesting thing. So I taught 6th to 12th grade, every topic except for shop.
Jeez.
And so all these kids that I taught had me for every class.
Lucky them.
For 6 years. So you would think this is great, you know, that I really get to know them, and boy, you know, I'm delivering professional parenting, teaching. But there's this one kid I could never get to. Oh. And so he didn't like me. I couldn't figure out how to solve it. And he was stuck with me 8 hours a day for like six years.
Oh, my gosh.
So I don't want to know what happened to him.
Yeah.
I just don't want to know.
Yeah. His worst nightmare, you for 8 hours a day for 6 years.
Right. You know, what did I not do for him?
So,
but it is an interesting question how kids grow. And, you know, if you're a parent, you're living with them in the moment. Mm-hmm. And you go back and you look at photos and you're all rosy and nostalgic. So a lot of us don't actually sort of get to follow it and see what happens. But our guest today has been doing this.
Wow.
So I'm very pleased to introduce Professor Ramon Martinez. He's at the School of Education at Stanford. He taught elementary school in Los Angeles. He taught in Prague, the Czech Republic, for a year.
Ooh.
He taught at Cal State Long Beach in the teacher ed program. He studies race and language in education. And he's particularly interested in the everyday language and literacy practices of bilingual Chicano and Latino Latinx children and youth. So welcome, Ramon.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So tell us about this longitudinal study. I mean, I've heard little bits about it, and it just seems to me insane. So explain.
Well, I'm excited about it. I've been shadowing a group of kids at a small public school in Los Angeles. It's a K-12 school, and I've been shadowing this group of kids since they were kindergartners and first graders. They just finished 8th and 9th grade, so they'll be going into 9th and 10th in the fall.
So that's like hoop dreams, real life.
Right?
Yeah, hoop dreams. For those who don't know, this was this great TV show, movie, where they picked a bunch of kids, I think in middle school, and followed them all the way to their NBA mm-hmm. aspirations. So how did you pick these kids? Because that was always the question for Hoop Dreams. How do they know these kids would be interesting to follow?
Exactly. Kind of like the 21 Up series as well.
Yeah.
Both of those, I think, films inspired me. So this is a group of kids I started shadowing because I helped start this school. So when I was a doctoral student at UCLA, I helped start a university-assisted school.
Wow.
And then I got my first tenure-track job at the University of Texas at Austin in 2009. So I moved from LA to Austin just as the school was set to open. And so sort of torn, right? Because I had been with the project, kind of creating the school, putting the proposal together, and I had to leave right at the moment it was about to open. So I was excited to kind of stay connected in some way, shape, or form. And so I was actually the first study. It's a school that has lots of researchers there, mostly from UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I was the first. Mine was the first study to get started at the school. So I've been shadowing these kids since. It's a cohort of kids in a multi-age classroom. That's why they were K-1.
I see.
So it's a multi-age kindergarten, first grade classroom, and I've been shadowing this group of kids. It was 20 kids initially, Now there are about 9 of the original 20 still at the school.
Wow.
And so it's sort of been shrinking organically, but in a way that makes it easier to kind of keep track of the kids.
So just so it isn't too creepy, what when you say you shadow them, what does that mean?
Shadow does sound creepy, doesn't it?
I thought about it differently. Like you're in a dark cloak.
Shady in the corner.
Right. So maybe, so what I've been doing is hanging out with these kids. And initially it was at the end of every school year. So I'd go down there for up to 2 months initially when my semester ended in Texas. I'd go out to LA and there were still 2 full months, 8 weeks of school left. So I'd be in the classroom 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. Monday through Friday every day.
Wow.
With this group of kindergartners and first graders.
Would you go out at recess too?
I would
and
go,
like hang on
literally hang out with them, sticking out like a sore thumb at recess and lunch.
Swinging on the swing.
So you get to know their parents as well?
I got to know some of the parents, not all, but some of the parents.
Yeah.
I remember the first day of kindergarten for this one girl. She was a Filipina girl. Her parents brought her into this classroom. It's a Spanish-English dual language classroom. So at the kindergarten first grade level, 90% of the instruction is in Spanish. And so I remember seeing the parents walk this girl into the room. They stand there. They hear the teacher speaking only in Spanish. They stood there for about 5 minutes, and they were just looking at each other the whole time and then walked out. And so I kind of followed them out and talked to them. And as it turns out, they were a little concerned because they didn't speak Spanish.
Right.
Their daughter didn't speak Spanish.
Right.
So I tried to sort of allay their fears, kind of explain to them what the rationale was for a sort of 90-10 immersion model. I tried to help them see that their daughter would be fine.
Yeah.
Within a year, she was one of the top students in the class, reciting her poetry to a group of mostly Latina moms, who were standing ovation for her poetry in Spanish. So
what a sweet story.
Yeah.
So this is a huge time investment on your part. You are a researcher. Anything jump out at you? Insights or an appreciation of the complexity or?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an amazing group of kids. They're bi and multilingual.
Mm-hmm.
And so what stands out to me and what I'm interested in is, well, what are these kids doing with language? What are their everyday ways of using language, ways with words, so to speak? We're often told, teachers are often told, educators are often told, you know, build on the resources, the cultural linguistic resources that kids bring to the classroom, their funds of knowledge, so to speak. But I think teachers are seldom given concrete or specific ideas about what that might look like, what it might sound like, what might that mean. And so my research sort of takes that as a starting point to say, well, what do these kids bring to the table in terms of linguistic competencies, skills? What are they doing with language? Sort of their linguistic toolkit, if you will.
Yeah. So as a teacher, like, what would you tell me? What's my biggest tip? What would I do with these students?
Yeah, I think the biggest tip, because I try not to be too prescriptive, but I understand that teachers need answers. So what I've tried to do is use this linguistic toolkit metaphor as sort of a way to introduce principles, right? And the principle is this, that all kids come to school with a linguistic toolkit, right? Every kid brings something. Imagine a kindergartner showing up the first day of kindergarten. He's got this bright, shiny toolkit. And some teachers, I think, are really skilled. And you both were probably those kinds of teachers or know those kinds of teachers, right? Where you kind of invite a kid to open up and share what's inside their linguistic toolkits. But sometimes, and I've seen this happen, teachers kind of rifle through those toolkits sort of carelessly, haphazardly, searching for that one thing, right? That one thing they're looking for is a hammer, maybe with a shiny hammer with a red grip, right?
Yeah.
And that stands for whatever you want, standard American English, academic language, right? It's that one thing they're looking for. And I guess what my concern is that a lot of times teachers don't see that tool in there because they're too busy tossing aside all these tools. Sometimes it's in there, but they just toss it aside because they see all these other things that they don't recognize. They don't know what to do with them. But sometimes I feel like teachers, you know, maybe there's no red hammer in there, but there's lots of really valuable tools that can help fashion a nice hammer, right? So there's lots of tools that could be used as a resource for teachers, as a point of pedagogical leverage, but teachers don't know what to do with it. So,
That's really interesting. So this is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Mary Lee Opezzo. We're speaking with Ramon Martinez about linguistic toolkits and his interesting longitudinal study with students. So tell me more about that toolkit. So what's an example of a tool as a naive teacher I might accidentally throw out when looking for this hammer?
Right. That's a great question. So I think the kinds of things I've found are these. I've found kids speaking multiple languages, multiple dialects of different languages, different registers, styles, seeing kids code switching or mixing, translanguaging, if you will, sort of mixing back and forth between different languages. I've seen kids interpreting and translating. So all kinds of things that kids do with language, all of that counts in my book as sort of linguistic skill, linguistic dexterity.
So I've got a kid who's code switching, and I'm a teacher. How do I take advantage of that?
And just for my naive self, code switching means?
Ramon, give an example.
So code switching is a term that mainstream linguists have used to talk about what people do when they go back and forth between languages. So if I'm speaking English to Dan right here, luego te hablo a ti en español, that's an example of intersentential code switching, right? Code switching between sentences.
Cool.
But sometimes people will do that even within the sentence or phrase boundary, and that's been referred to as intrasentential code switching.
Whoa.
Así le da comer mi mama a mi nephew. That's how my mom feeds my nephew, right? I've heard kids say things like that. These are real examples from the data I've collected. So
wow.
It's a normal way of doing being bilingual. For kids anywhere around the world where two or more languages come into contact, people are going to mix those languages. Linguists have historically called this code switching, sometimes code mixing. Mm. There is a body of scholarship now that's talking about it as translanguaging, right?
Has Spanglish disappeared?
Spitalian.
Right. Spanglish was never an officially recognized term, right?
Oh.
But it is. And it was historically used as a pejorative term, right? It's something that people have used negatively. Like, well, he doesn't speak English or Spanish well. He just kind of jumbles them all together. Mm-hmm. That's Spanglish. But what I've seen over the past 20 years is kids kind of taking that term and sort of semantically inverting it, right? Turning the meaning inside out and using it in a very positive, affirming way, the way many people do with negative terms, right?
So back to the example, I'm a teacher and I've found a kid who, I've looked in their toolbox, I've found all sorts of, lots of nails, screws.
Where's the hammer?
Yeah, I like the metaphor. And then I see code switching. So as a teacher, how do I turn that into advantage?
Yeah, well, that's been a key focus of my work, is to help teachers and other educators see this as something that's not just cute, right? Not just interesting or fascinating, right? Mm. But something that overlaps with the kinds of things that we call smart, the kinds of things that we say we want kids to do, the kinds of things we talk about in standards. So, for example, with code switching, when kids mix languages, I see them and hear them doing all kinds of things, right? Communicatively, I see them and hear them shifting voices for different audiences, communicating subtle shades or nuances of meaning, reporting speech, indexing or signaling solidarity, intimacy, right, identity. So there's all kinds of functions, communicative functions that code switching or code mixing or translanguaging, if you want to call it that, all kinds of functions that can serve.
So you've been following these kids for a long time. Do these things change? Do they evolve over time? Like the kids start out sort of code switching without awareness, and then suddenly they're aware, and now they're starting to use code switching and to their advantage. Or
I think it has to change a little bit over time. I think kids are made aware of it. In my case, I've sort of muddied the waters because I ask them about this kind of thing every year, and so now they know. They're onto me, right?
So have they gotten more sophisticated?
I think they have. I mean, part of the sort of focus of my work has been to say, well, let's look beyond these sort of labels or categories like English learner or even bilingual that obscure what kids are doing. They sort of conceal more than they reveal, right? And I'll give you one example is a girl who was a kindergartner. We interviewed her. Then again, in third grade, we interviewed her. And she, as it turns out, spoke English, Spanish, an indigenous Mexican language called Zapotec or Zapoteco. And we did this language mapping activity where we said, tell us who you speak English with and Spanish with and Zapotec with and where and when and why. So she created this map. And at one point, she told us she lived with an uncle who didn't speak. And one of my research assistants said, well, does he speak with his hands? And she told us, the interview was in Spanish. She said, well, sometimes. And I was amazed. And I said, well, so what kinds of things does he say with his hands? She proceeded to sign.
Wow.
And so, you know,
that's another
example of her expansive linguistic repertoire. We had no idea for 3 years that this girl could sign. This is another part of her communicative toolkit, right, that we have no idea was there. We weren't sure what to call it. But I think we do know what to call it. It's language, right? It's a use of signs and symbols to make meaning. And the point that I sort of make with that example is if bilingual or trilingual even isn't generous enough a term to do justice to a girl like that, then bilingual certainly isn't good enough. And if bilingual isn't good enough, then English learner, you begin to see how inadequate those labels are and how they can kind of obstruct our view of what kids are capable of.
Absolutely. Wow. So thank you so much. This is Schools In, just to remind you, with Dan Schwartz and Mary Leo Pezzo. We're speaking with Ramon Martinez about fascinating ideas of code switching and a really sweet story about a girl whose linguistic toolkit was obscured just by not even knowing what to tap into. That's really fascinating.
Good job, Marilee. Good summary. That was very good.
Thank you.
So The way you're speaking, it sounds to me like the first thing I should learn from your work is to respect the kinds of language skills that kids come forward with.
Yeah, prepare to be surprised, right?
Yeah, but I'm still going to keep pushing on this.
Sure.
So I'm a teacher. I looked through the toolbox. I found a tool.
Yep.
What do I do to nurture, cultivate, get them to use that tool?
Jiu-jitsu the tool into something strong.
Yes. Kung fu. Have it run past me as I... Yeah.
Right. So I think part of it, again, is I realize I haven't answered the question yet, but I was starting to, and I think I went off on a tangent.
It's her fault.
No, it's totally her fault.
I tend to go off on tangents.
She's the guest host.
It's all my fault. The sub-teacher, blame it.
Shoot a spitball at her. It's fine.
So I think it's important for teachers to understand that what these kids are doing when they mix languages, for example, is not just cute or interesting, but that it's actually aligned with and overlaps with the kinds of standards that we articulate for kids. So when we say we want kids to develop and display audience awareness, guess what? I see kids doing that. When they're mixing languages. Now, it may not be in exactly the same way that we want them to display audience awareness in their writing or in their oral presentations, but it's close enough, right? Close enough to serve as a point of pedagogical leverage, right?
So I might say to the kid, you know what you've just done? You've done X. And I make them aware and I say, here are some other examples of people who do X.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
And then so they can get a toehold into the task.
It's sort of like holding up a mirror to a kid and saying, look how smart you are. Look what you're already doing.
Yeah.
And look how close that is to this other thing that we say we want you to do.
Look at your great social skills that you're already displaying naturally.
Yep, absolutely. Another quick example is translating and interpreting. We've done work years ago. I did work where we worked with a group of kids who translated and interpreted for their immigrant parents. We had them reenact translating or interpreting scenarios. We had them sort of unpack those scenarios and identify as a class, what are the skills embedded and displayed in this sort of use of language? And then we had them apply those same skills to writing for different audiences, right? A persuasive writing unit for a sixth grade classroom, for example, is a perfect opportunity to tap into the audience awareness and the kind of ways that kids shift voices for different audiences and put things in their own words, paraphrase. I mean, that's what we ask kids to do all the time.
Right.
You know, not plagiarize, but paraphrase. And here I see kids, when they're translating, interpreting, putting things in their own words all the time. So lots of examples like that. And the reason I hesitate to be too prescriptive is because who knows if kids are translating? Any given classroom, you could have kids who are translating or not, kids who are mixing languages or not, kids who speak multiple languages, signed and spoken languages or not, right? And so I think that the principle is expect that your kids are doing something and expect that in a classroom where kids oftentimes get to do very little talk, we're seeing the tip of the iceberg in terms of what these kids can do. And so that all kids bring a toolkit, and we probably have only sort of peered into it a little bit, right? That it needs to be sort of fully unpacked in order to understand the competencies these kids bring to the classroom.
Wow. Thank you so much. This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Marilee Opesso. More with Ramon Martinez later after the break.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Marilee Opesso. We're talking with Ramon Martinez about ways that teachers could hold up mirrors to their students to reveal their hidden linguistic talents.
Beautiful. Beautiful. So I'm going to try and get at this in a slightly different way about teaching and how you can take advantage of this. So as dean, it's surprising how much I actually know about what's going on at the school, right? It's not like I'm sitting in this top of a tower with just a picture window and a red phone.
That suite at the top of the high rise.
Right, and just the emergency phone that I need to pick up. Yes, sir. So Ramon, the students love you. They love you. And so I want to know why the students love you. And
he's asking because he wants to bring his student ratings up.
That is correct. So one possibility is you dress really well.
I think that's probably not it.
Okay.
So superficial, Dan.
I am a shallow guy.
He also knows that I don't dress very well.
No, you're in a tux. Nobody can. Okay. So my guess is that you take the theories you've developed from the K-12 space and you apply them in your classes, right? And so what does that look like? When you try and take some of your theories about seeing what's in the toolbox, and now you're teaching, say, pre-service teachers, mm-hmm. you know, how do you execute on that?
That's a great question. Next question, please. I said I wouldn't skirt any more questions. No, I do.
I'm lucky. My theory of pedagogy is you just tell people stuff.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And then, you know, I do it. I
did unidirectional teaching.
Pretty much. I said, put your head down and do the work. So.
Yeah. No, I, in all seriousness, I do try to take the insights that I glean from the research I do and bring them into my teaching, infuse them into my teaching somehow. And I guess one of the biggest principles is, you know, as I've learned so much from kids, I want to give them the benefit of the doubt. I want teachers to give kids the benefit of the doubt, to presume competence, right? To presume that they know rather than presuming that they don't know. I try to do the same thing with my students, whether they're doctoral students, master's students, the teacher ed candidates that we prepare here.
So how do you sit there and sift through their toolbox?
I actually ask them, I use that same metaphor with them, that same sort of analogy, right? And I say, you know, we all talk differently across different audiences. I mean, each and every one of you, I say to all 90 of the teacher ed candidates, when you leave here, you're going somewhere, home, to study, to a library, maybe to play sports, maybe some religious or nonprofit sort of space. Wherever you go, you're talking to different audiences, different groups of people. So you yourselves are shifting voices for different audiences. And there's not a single one of you that speaks only in English or only in standard, quote unquote, American English all the time. So think about how you shift voices, how you speak in different languages, dialects, registers, styles. Do you ever mix languages? Do you translate? Do you interpret? And I actually do the kind of language mapping activity with teachers first, with teacher candidates first. And I think that's important because if teachers are going to recognize the richness of their kids, their students' linguistic repertoires, I think it's a prerequisite. They have to be able to recognize their own linguistic competencies and strengths.
Wow, that's interesting. So, like, I speak with my grandma much differently than I speak with my, you know, 3-year-old godchild with, you know, a puppet in my hand.
Absolutely. And those differences are not just limited to, like, syntax, right?
Or
lexicon, like vocabulary. Mm-hmm. You know, you can measure the intonational contours of someone's speech, the tone, the volume.
Wow.
Everything varies, right? There's people talk about this register of sort of motherese, fatherese, parentese, right? The way we talk to kids or sometimes even pets.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be appropriate right now, probably, with you two, right?
I can talk like I'm talking to my dog.
So again, they've now developed an appreciation for the variability and validity of language use. Then what?
I think the next step is to help them see how that's smart, that it's smart and how it's smart, and how it connects with the kinds of things that we typically view as being smart, as being important. So whether it's Common Core State Standards in English Language Arts that talk about audience awareness, that talk about communicating shades or nuances of meaning, et cetera. I think it's making the connection between what kids are already doing, what teachers are already doing, and the things that we say we want them to be able to do.
So, Marilee, do you think we could also do the same sort of approach with math? We open up their toolkit of mathematical things, or would we look at it and just say, no, that's wrong? Sorry, 2 + 3 = 5.
Right. Yeah, your tool for math is wrong. Here's another toolbox that you can purchase.
Isn't that what we do?
I mean, I guess so. Right. So this is really unique. And to answer that question shortly, I'm going to first remind everyone that this is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Marilee Opezzo, and we're speaking with Ramon Martinez about, is it possible that there is an incorrect toolbox, and how making students know that they're smart already is actually a really good teaching tip.
Is there anything wrong in the toolbox that the kids have? It's all good.
Well, here's the thing. I think I'm less interested in talking about what's wrong with kids' toolkits than I am with helping teachers see how what they're already doing overlaps with the things we want them to do. Because I think we talk about things like standard American English and academic language as if they were sort of this cloud up in the sky that kids could never attain, right? And what I'm really invested in is helping teachers see the standardized things that kids are already doing in language, the academic things that kids are already doing with language. And sometimes these things are pretty glaringly obvious to me, but not always obvious to teachers, right?
That's really interesting. So you're not auto-correcting them like Word is.
Not at all. No, yeah. No auto-correct here.
So I had an interesting experience that I've still been trying to parse, where I met with this couple in their living room to talk about, you know, the education. And they spoke sort of the Queen's English the whole time. Mm-hmm. And the intonation was the kind of language you would use if you were speaking to an audience of like 40 or 50. And it was so bizarre.
Wow.
I mean, it was perfect.
Did you look over your shoulder for the
attending
crowd?
You know, I just kept thinking, I better not use a contraction. You know, but it was weird. It was it was sort of like, this is the standardized English.
And they
were executing on it, and it was so abnormal.
Wow.
It's really weird.
Wow.
Well, that makes me think of this sort of tension, right? Because we want kids to be able to speak in standardized ways, whatever we think that means, right?
Right?
We want them to be able to sort of access dominant codes of power, to engage with sort of
codes
mainstream
of
audiences,
wow.
right? But I think we don't want just that. I think we want kids to be able to engage with multiple audiences. And I think we're good in terms of trying to prepare kids to engage with monolingual English-speaking audiences. And with bilingual dual-language education, we're good with preparing kids to engage with monolingual Spanish or Tagalog or Mandarin-speaking audiences. But I think what we don't ever do is prepare kids to speak with audiences like themselves. Bilingual.
That's really
kids who grow up as simultaneous bilinguals, growing up speaking two languages simultaneously, we never value those audiences. We never prepare kids to engage with a world that looks and sounds like them. And I think that's sort of the missing piece, right?
It's really interesting.
Where are you coming from? Yeah.
So, but your view of school is you're preparing them for large linguistic interactions. I think other people think I'm preparing them to be able to write a brief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so how do I think about this? These two?
I think we can think about them as not being mutually exclusive. I think kids can do both. It's a both and proposition in my opinion.
Synergistic? Possibly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I see kids. I left the research site a few years ago now, and was starving and stopped at a taco truck. And a kid popped out of the window of the taco truck who was in my study. And
wow.
I had no idea that he, I mean, I guess I knew that he worked in the taco truck, but I didn't know it was right there. And he surprised me. And so I watched him interact with a Korean man. He switched to English, switched back to Spanish to talk to a Latino customer, back and forth, counted change back. Like properly, quote
wow.
unquote.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
And so I saw all of this thing, numeracies, literacies,
yeah,
you
yeah.
name it. And I became fascinated. A year later, I interviewed him, and he spoke for an hour, a little over an hour straight. He was a fifth grader at the time.
Oh my gosh.
I said, well, do you have to be smart to work in a taco truck? What kinds of things do you need to know? And he went off.
So I have a friend who is in Europe, and he already speaks like six languages, mm-hmm. and he decided he's going to learn German. Mm-hmm. And he's doing it over a period of weeks. And I said, but you're going to walk into these meetings and you're just going to butcher the language. And he says, it's okay. We're all butchering one another's language. It's fine.
Right.
Right? The point is to communicate.
Right. Absolutely.
And to try.
And to try.
On that note, gosh, thank you so much for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Marilee Opezzo. If you've missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app, iTunes, and SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.